I trust you all had a pleasant afternoon. I certainly did. And I hope you are ready to study along with us as we look at a lesson about Christian conduct in general, and in a more specific sense, the admonition, the description that Jesus said in the text that our brother read for us a moment ago, "Ye are the salt of the earth." And this, of course, comes from what I and many others would say was the greatest sermon ever preached, known as the Sermon on the Mount. The Beatitudes taught us that true happiness does not lie where most people are looking, but rather they lie in the things of Christ. They lie in those who are poor in spirit and who are mourning sin, and they lie in meekness and gentleness and righteousness and mercy and purity of heart. Now, during the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus used several metaphors. And we see one right here in the text that our brother read for us a moment ago. "Ye are the salt of the earth." And then in verse 14, he followed that up with another metaphor. "Ye are the light of the world." And Jesus often used these descriptions to these figures of speech to get across to his audience a spiritual point. And that's exactly why we use metaphors in the world today. We're trying to make a point. We're trying to get somebody that doesn't understand the main point to understand it by using a parallel kind of point. We might just describe somebody that has a quick temper, and they say, "Boy, he goes off like a firecracker. He goes off quickly. He goes off and it's something you can't ignore." So we use these figures of speech to try to get these spiritual points across. And what our Savior is trying to get across with this brief metaphor is that yours and mine, our saltiness or our influence determines the beneficent influence that you and I will have on those around us, whether they're members of the church or whether they are still sinners in the world. But our saltiness, and that's not to be thought of in a negative sense. Now, that's another metaphor, though, isn't it? We sometimes say somebody is old, that's old grumpy, and we say, "Boy, he's a grumpy old salt, isn't he?" Or, "Boy, that was a rather salty comeback." You know, you walk up and say, "Hey, how you doing?" "I'm fine. How are you?" "Well, that was a pretty salty response." So but Jesus is using salt here in a good sense, in the valuable sense. And in antiquity, salt was valuable because it was a very, very important commodity in Palestine. It wasn't just a condiment that was put on the table. It had a higher degree of value, especially in the fishing industry. That's how fish was preserved. You know, fish would be caught near the shoreline, and then sometimes it would be transported inland several miles, and so that the fish wouldn't putrefy and rot. Why it was often packed in salt to preserve it. And we've had, you know, salt treated pork and different things like that. And so it was a very, very important commodity in first century Palestine. The Dead Sea was known for its salt deposits, so much so that it was often called the Salt Sea because of its extreme saltiness. And I'm told, I've never been there, but I'm told that there are things that can float in the Dead Sea that won't float anywhere else because of the the salt content in the water makes the water more buoyant. And I've heard tell of people laying on their back and falling asleep on the sea because the water is so buoyant that they'll just lay there and float. Don't know if that's the case, but maybe somebody was using a metaphor. I don't know. But the thing about the salt that comes from the Dead Sea is it's an inferior grade of salt as opposed to the salt that is mined inland. It was full of impurities. And the salt from the Dead Sea could actually become unsalty. The salt itself could dissolve away, but it would leave a residue of impurities that were not particularly salty. Edward Robinson discovered a mountain of salt some 5 miles wide in the Dead Sea. And so it was a major source of salt. So all these things the people in Palestine would be familiar with. And there is a lot of biblical symbolism with regard to salt that we may not realize, we may not remember. The Old Testament mentions a covenant of salt between Israel and Jehovah God in Numbers 18 and in 2 Chronicles 13. Salt was exchanged between parties of a reciprocal covenant, and it was a symbol, it was a sign of, you know, I'm going to give you salt to prove that I'm going to be faithful to the covenant you and I have made. And then likewise, this other fellow, the other party, would give you some of his salt for the same reason. And so there was salt involved in these covenants. And God pledged his faithfulness to the Israelites. And in turn, they pledged faithfulness to God, God being the source of salt. And salt being used in many of the sacrifices. And Christ may have had this in mind when he began this salt metaphor, for as when one makes the good confession before baptism, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, he is entering a covenant relationship with Jehovah God. And the candidate for baptism upon this confession of faith, a lot more is really said there when we say, I believe that Jesus is the Son of God, because not only that, but we are saying then that we love Jesus, that we are going to be committed to the will of Jesus, that we understand the need for Jesus' atoning sacrifice. Now, I think the Jews on Pentecost probably were mature enough to understand that. And I have a lot of people that will come to me and ask me, you know, is my grandson or is my son or daughter old enough to be baptized? Well, you know, and I know there's no age restriction. It is more of the old preachers used to call it the age of accountability. Well, age is kind of a misleading word because the age has nothing to do with it, but the mental capacity to understand. So I refer to it as the mentality of accountability. It's widely known, and this is no slight to the boys, but girls typically at prepubescent ages tend to mature a little faster, not only physically but also mentally in some states. In some areas, some degree. So we have to take that into consideration. But I always, my stock answer is, if when they ask me, is my child ready to be baptized? Well, one of the first things I asked is he or she capable of understanding the significance of the virgin birth? And that's a pretty good, barometer. It's not chiseled in stone, but if they have the mental capacity to understand what is significant about a virgin birth or a virgin conception, literally, then chances are they can understand a concept like an atoning death, and really who Jesus is. So when one makes that good confession, it's a promise to God that, and we are responding to the promise that God has made man. He promised that if we are sincere in our belief and we understand these things, that he is going to forgive us our sins, and we are going to be dedicated to him throughout the time of our sojourn here on earth. We have in a symbol then exchanged salt. We have made that commitment. And there are a lot of things involved in this. There is, when we think about what literal salt does, there is this idea of purification that goes hand in hand with salt. In Leviticus 2, we learn that every sacrifice in the Old Testament, every animal sacrifice in the Old Testament, was to be offered with salt. And that's one of those little tidbits we pick up in that long, laborious book of Leviticus. You know, the book of Leviticus that has all those, you know, 2/10 deals of flour and a hen of oil. And we get, you know, we start getting tunnel vision when we start reading all those various laws and different things. But this is one of those little things that we pick up in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus 2:13 says, "And every oblation of thy meat offering shalt thou season with salt. Neither shalt thou suffer the salt of the covenant of thy God to be lacking from the meat offering. With all thine offering thou shalt offer salt." So salt had its place in the offerings that were made by the Israelites. And it makes sense for an animal sacrifice. You know, the priest, the portion that wasn't burned, the priests ate. And they would want that to be preserved. I know I would. And since they didn't have refrigeration like we have, the salt was the key. Salt was also offered with meal offerings, and that was symbolic of the salt symbolism of purity. So salt could kill fungus and different things upon it. So, you know, when next time your doctor tells you you need to cut back on your salt, ask him why he's against the biblical mandates for salt. Do you realize that every Old Testament sacrifice is typical of the sacrifice of Christ? I want you to do something in your spare time. Study Leviticus chapters 1 through 5. And I want you to note the different thrusts of the sacrifices described and draw that association with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. I think you'll find it very interesting. Leviticus 1 through 5, and compare those sacrifices with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. So there is, and one of the things that we'll find is the purity of Christ. So when we think of salt and we think of that purity, well, then we can also associate that with the purity of Jesus Christ, who was tempted in all points like as we are, yet was without sin. He was without putrefaction or putrefaction. Hebrews 4 and verse 15. And there was an absolute purity requirement of Christ for his role as our justifier. You know, he's the one that justified us, the just and the justifier, Romans 3:26. So there's that purity aspect in it. There's also the salt of Christian influence that we need to be concerned about. Since salt is associated with purity, and since Jesus admonished Christians to be salt of the earth, Christians are to provide that purifying influence on the wicked world. In other words, we are to show ourselves a pattern of purity. To the early heathens in the age of Christ, the idea of conscience was relatively unknown. They didn't necessarily acknowledge conscience. And I know we talked about conscience a little bit this morning. But their idea of conscience was, hey, that's going to make me feel good, so I'm going to do it. That was all their conscience was worried about. They had no concept of negative impact of their actions. You know as well as I know that from science we learn that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Well, the same thing is in the spiritual world. Every action we take has an equal and opposite reaction. If we sin, we die. We are dead men walking. We're going to die the second death. But if our actions are good and right and wholesome, then at the judgment, we are going to receive that good and right reward from the God who created us. The heathens, again, they had no thought of retribution or wickedness of their consequences. Well, if you remember how they worshipped a lot of their worship revolved around the sacred prostitute priestesses at these temples, and they would just go have physical relations, and that was their worship. Marriage was simply, you know, a wife back then was simply just a cook and a house cleaner and a baby factory. There was no sitting around the table discussing your day with the wife. When the wife wasn't feeding you or satisfying your physical needs, then you were off worshiping at the temple with the priestess prostitutes. And there was no consequences to them for that. That was just rampant adultery and fornication. And they didn't worry a thing about it. That was the accepted life. And Rome was no better. You know, people say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. There's a lot more behind that statement. We ought to think about that statement a little bit before we just flippantly use it, because it's typically talking about the sacred rituals, the so-called, of the pagans. And we can compare that with the statements that we read in Romans chapter 1, where the women or the men had disregarded the natural use of the woman and burned in their lusts one for another. Edward Gibbon, in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, wrote, "The primitive Christian demonstrated his faith by his virtues, and it was very justly supposed that the divine persuasion which enlightened and subdued the understanding must at the same time purify the hearts and direct the actions of the believer." So the non-Christian people in the first century, they saw the Christians as somebody who was different. They had a different gait about them. They did different things. Pliny, who was the governor of Bithynia, wrote to Trajan in 112 AD, "Christians abstain from theft, robbery, adultery, and breach of faith." These were some of the prime virtues of paganism, but the Christians knew them not as virtues, but rather as vices. And it was an astonishing thing. Well, you can tell a Christian because he doesn't steal. And he doesn't pilfer. And he doesn't go to the temple where all the prostitutes are. And if he says something, you can take him at his word. Isn't that strange? That was their idea. They noticed that the Christians were different. You know, and you think of salt. Salt is different than the fish it preserves. Salt is different than the meat it preserves. Salt is different than that open wound which... When salt is put in an open wound, yes, it's quite an irritant, but it can promote healing. When I was a freshman in high school, I've never told some of you this, and it was kind of a disgusting thing to see, but when I was a freshman in high school, on my two hands, I had over 57 warts. All over my fingers, my hands, I looked like a witch from the wrists down. But I had all these warts, and they had been, I'd tried Compound W and Duofilm acid and different things, and it just wouldn't get rid of them. So we made an appointment about the second week of school. I don't know why it ended up that way. And I had typing class, so that's why I never learned to type very well, because I went to a doctor, and he took basically a wood burner, and he started working on those warts. And then, so I had all these, I mean, it was just a mess. And I went to typing class, and after one class, Miss Lore says, "You're not typing again until you heal up," because she had a mess to clean up on my typewriter after I was done, if you can imagine. So after about 2 weeks of that, and they didn't seem like they were healing at all. Well, as my fortune would have it, Dad had scheduled a vacation, and we went to Myrtle Beach. And after about 4 days of swimming in the ocean, guess what? By the time we got home, those things were almost healed. Now, it burned a little bit when I first went in the water, but after a little bit, you didn't think about it. Christians have that kind of influence where they can. Should I say, we better have that kind of an influence. So salt is for purity. It is for influence, and it's also for seasoning. Remember in Job chapter 6, verse 6, "Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg?" Well, there is if you put salt on it, I guess. That's what Job's talking about. Salt is a staple of our daily lives, and it has a very profound effect on our enjoyment of life. You know, there's nothing like, and I'm going to use a food metaphor here. To me, I don't salt my food anymore, except watermelon. And I got to put salt in a little bowl of beans with some cornbread. Other than that, I don't salt anything. But boy, it just enhances the flavor and the enjoyment of it. Christians are to have that same kind of influence. We should add something to people's lives. Something positive. Whether they perceive it as positive or not. It wasn't always positive to me when Mom was waking me up on Sunday morning and dragging me to church when I was a little boy. I wanted to watch cartoons, or I wanted to stay home or do something different. I didn't see it as positive. But Mom was being salt, and Grandma was being salt. Dad wasn't being salt yet. He wasn't a Christian then. Our lives ought to flavor and influence the lives of those around us with good, whether they perceive it or not. We encourage people to think about their soul. Whether they realize it or not, that's helping them. That is kind of like salt in a wound. It doesn't feel very good. Maybe they don't like it. But it's helping them. It's designed to benefit them. You know, and again, we make that comparison. Salt to an open wound is an irritant. Salt to food adds flavor. But the Christian salt, whether it's salt on a wound or salt to add flavor, it is doing some real good in the lives of other folks. And that's what we're to be about, to spread the gospel. I've told you, and other preachers have told you, that the church, we make Christians in order to make more Christians. We are a self-proclaimed perpetuating organism. Paul wrote to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, "The things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others," and so on and so on and so on. Jesus said in Mark 9:50, "Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, wherewith will you season it?" And that again is a reference to maybe to that salt that come from the Dead Sea that could lose its saltiness. So when salt loses its saltiness, what do you do with it? Well, Jesus said it's good for nothing but to make a sidewalk out of. It's just to be cast under the foot of men. The rabbis, they had another response to it. And some of you will get this right off, and some of you won't understand it. They would go to the rabbis and say, "We've got some salt. How do we make it salty again, Rabbi?" And the rabbi would say, "Add to it some mule afterbirth." Do you get the significance of it? There's no such thing as mule afterbirth. Mules are sterile. Basically, he's saying there's nothing you can do with it but go get some salt. Go get some salt. So that's what we have to be. There's no replacement for the kind of salt that you and I have to be. We can't fake it. We have to be sincere. We have to be pure about it. So we can either provide flavor to our family, to our community, to our church, or we can be salt in an open wound. We can be an irritant to them. But from early on, there have been problems in the church because of negatively salty people who are unspiritually minded. So there's salt and seasoning. But there's also salt and preservation. Salt has been used throughout history to preserve meat, to preserve food. And righteous people, we are to be salt in that we are to preserve against destruction. We are to try to solve problems and rather than being problems. God told Abraham that he would not receive the promised land in his lifetime because the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full, Genesis 15:16. A key factor in the timetable of the Amorites' destruction was the level of righteousness in the land. Once their salt level had declined enough, God saw to it that they were overthrown. And then the promise was fulfilled, but not in the lifetime of Abraham. Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed for a lack of 10 grains of salt. 10 righteous people. Think about that. The Proverbs writer says that righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. The faithful Christians in this world right now, think about this one. The faithful Christians in this world right now may be the only reason this world is still spinning. Maybe all the Christians throughout the world, maybe we are the 10 righteous people that's saving this earth from destruction because of the salt that we have in us. I think it's a very real possibility. Now, if you look at Barna or Pew or one of the other research things, they use the term Christian very loosely, okay? I'm talking about genuine Christians as defined by the Bible. So that gets rid of the Roman church. That gets rid of every man-made denomination. And that leaves the true adherence to Christ. We are a very small remnant. But you know as well as I do, it just takes a few shakes of salt and a bowl of beans to make a difference. And maybe we're just making that difference right now. Imagine a world without the salt of Christianity. We can go home and look on the news and we see riots here and protests there and bombings and shootings and wars and fighting. And we might think to ourselves for a moment, where is God? Where is the Christian influence? I tell you, it would be a whole lot worse were it not for the remnant of Christ in the world today. And so this evening, a couple questions for yourself, for reflection. Does my salt purify and preserve, or am I merely salt in an open wound for the sake of being an irritant? Do I have the salt in myself to keep the covenant that I made with God? And these are questions we need to consider and ask of ourselves on occasion. Am I salt that has lost its saltiness and am good only to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men? In other words, is my influence leading other men to hell, or is my influence leading men towards the righteous goal of heaven? These are things we need to be conscious of and aware of as we endeavor to get through this life and finally reach heaven. Just some things to ponder. Jesus said to his disciples, and by extension to us, because we are disciples, you are the salt of the earth. We are the source of the salt that many people in the world are going to see. And if they don't see our Christian influence, then they're not going to see a Christian influence. And it needs to be us that is influencing, preserving, purifying, and seasoning the world for something better. And in the end, heaven. Are you a Christian this evening? Have you confessed Jesus as the Lord and Savior of your life? Have you repented of your sins? And have you been buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of those sins? If you've been lacking in any one of these, we would like to help you. We would like to encourage you to put your Lord on in baptism and then let your salt be broadcast around. If you are a child of God and you've been unfaithful, and you need the prayers of the church, it would be our great pleasure to help you and assist you in that endeavor as well. But we want you to be saved, and we want you to let your salt have its influence in the world around us. If you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, take a seat on the front row, would you please, right now as we stand and sing.